From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Clinton says he was even-handed in exercising line-item vetoes that cut almost $290 million from a military construction bill. And the president said he made hard choices that cut projects supported by both Democrats and Republicans. The 38 projects that were cut included a National Guard facility in South Dakota supported by Senate Minority Leader Tom Daschle. The president said that none of the projects he vetoed was requested by the Pentagon, and none would have contributed to troop readiness. It's the first time the president has used the new line-item veto power on spending measures. The Clinton administration says it's found more videotapes of the president meeting with big donors at the White House. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
Last week, the White House belatedly turned over 44 videotapes of the president meeting donors at the White House coffees. Those are events that the White House insists were fundraising-related but not actual fundraisers. White House spokesmen say the delay was an honest mistake. The president says he isn't disturbed by the failure to find the tapes, which were filmed by a special Defense Department communications agency.
I don't believe for a moment that any of the career military people in WACA would... In any way, deliberately didn't say anything about this. I think it was just an accident.
Republicans are furious that the tapes were turned over long after they were requested. This isn't the first time that White House materials have turned up months after they were subpoenaed. The chairman of the Senate Oversight Committee, Tennessee Republican Fred Thompson, says that the White House defense of incompetence is wearing thin. Mara Liasson, NPR News. The White House.
Space Shuttle Atlantis is back on solid ground following a successful landing at the Kennedy Space Center. This completes NASA's latest docking mission with the space station Mir. From member station WMFE, Pat Duggins reports.
When space shuttles come home, they don't come home quietly. Twin sonic booms come off the spacecraft's nose and tail, prompting complaints from as far north as Minnesota. Atlantis touched down after two Sunday opportunities were ruined by cloud cover. The landing means astronaut Mike Fole is back with his family after 145 days in orbit. Astronaut Dave Wolf took over for Fole on board the Russian space station Mir, and that means Wolf gets the headaches. The Mir crew had a problem to deal with when they tried to undock a robot cargo ship from Mir's rear docking port today. The Progress vehicle wouldn't let go. Wolf and his cosmonaut crewmates opened the hatch and found a clamp that was still locked shut. The problem was fixed, and the undocking is set for Tuesday. For NPR News, I'm Pat Duggins.
Stock prices closed higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 62 points to close at 8,100. In the broader market, advancing issues led declines by a margin of nearly 2-1 in moderate trading. Prices closed higher today on the NASDAQ and the American Stock Exchange. This is NPR News. An American won the Nobel Prize in Medicine today for his research into a previously unknown type of disease-causing agent. The prize went to Dr. Stanley Prusner of the University of California in San Francisco. Prusner was honored for his discovery of a type of infectious agent he called a prion. The 1982 discovery found that prions are a type of protein that exists in the brain and may be implicated in brain-wasting diseases such as mad cow disease and Alzheimer's. Preparations have begun for jury selection in the Unabomber trial. From member station KXKG in Sacramento, Bill Rickman reports.
About 600 people have been summoned to the California State Fairgrounds at Cal Expo in Sacramento to begin the screening process for jurors in the trial of Theodore Kaczynski, the suspected Unabomber. The potential candidates for the jury were pulled from 34 counties, the largest jury pool ever assembled in this federal district. Those assembled will answer a questionnaire to determine if they should be excused because of hardship. About half the pool is expected to be released on those grounds. The rest will be required to arrive on the first day of the trial for final jury selection, a process estimated to take 6 weeks. The trial is scheduled to begin on November 12th, but Kaczynski's defense team has said it plans to appeal Judge Garland Burrell's ruling allowing the prosecution to perform its own mental tests on Kaczynski. That appeal could delay the start of the trial. For NPR News, this is Bill Rickman in Sacramento.
Chrysler Corporation said today that it's voluntarily recalling more than a million minivans. The company said it's recalling minivans built between 1991 and 93 because of safety problems related to seat belts. I'm Corey Flintoff. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is All Things Considered. I'm Linda Wertheimer.
And I'm Marcia Brandwin. Today, Palestinians in the Gaza Strip celebrated the return of the founder of Hamas. Sheikh Ahmed Yassin, who was released from an Israeli jail last week, was released in the aftermath of a botched Israeli assassination attempt in Jordan. Two agents were arrested after they tried to kill a senior Hamas official. In addition to freeing the sheikh, Israel agreed to release at least 60 Palestinian prisoners. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu announced an investigation of the affair, which has rocked his government. We have two reports, starting with NPR's Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
Netanyahu said he takes full responsibility for any actions undertaken by the Mossad. Speaking at a news conference, he said Israel has always brought its soldiers back. It was the first time the Israeli government has admitted it was behind last month's bungled assassination attempt of Khaled Mashal, who was injected with poison by two Israeli agents. According to Israel television, Israel sent a doctor with the antidote that saved Mashal's life. Netanyahu today vehemently rejected suggestions that Israel should refrain from risky operations like the attempted assassination.
The greatest failure of all is to offer terrorism and terrorists the feeling, the reality, and the perception of immunity. The minute terrorists think that they can get away with it, they will. We won't let them get away with it. We'll fight them.
Netanyahu also appealed to the Israeli public not to give in to fear and to continue to support the government's fight against terrorism. He denied Israeli press reports that Hamas had offered a 10-year suspension of suicide bombings if Israel would stop Palestinian land confiscation and house demolitions. He said Hamas remains an implacable foe.
Hamas is a multifaceted organization. It has an internal structure, an external structure. There are factions inside, factions outside. All of them, they may disagree on a few things, but they seem to agree on the need to destroy the Jewish state. I haven't seen anything substantive or serious to disabuse me.
Netanyahu has been trying hard to handle the diplomatic fallout from the affair. Canada recalled its ambassador last week after it was shown that the Mossad agents used Canadian passports. Criticism also came from the United States. State Department spokesman Jamie Rubin.
The United States, as a matter of law, does not conduct assassinations. We have a law against that. Therefore, we're opposed to it, and therefore we're opposed to assassinations by other governments as well.
But what most worries Israeli officials is the effect on the relationship with Jordan, Israel's only ally in the region. The botched assassination attempt humiliated Jordan's King Hussein just before Jordanian elections. Israeli press reports say Netanyahu made a secret visit to Jordan over the weekend, but King Hussein refused to meet with him. According to the reports, Netanyahu did meet Crown Prince Hassan. Privately, Israeli officials say the affair couldn't have come at a worse time. U.S. Peace Envoy Dennis Ross arrived in Israel tonight to restart Israeli-Palestinian peace talks that have been frozen for 6 months. Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat needs to prove to his people that the peace process can get them concrete gains. But the release of Sheikh Yassin and his return to Gaza seems likely to strengthen Arafat's chief rival, Hamas. Linda Gradstein, NPR News, Jerusalem.
And I'm Eric Weiner in Gaza. Supporters of Hamas, or the Islamic Resistance Movement, had waited 8 years for this day, the day their leader, Sheikh Ahmed Yassin, returned to Gaza a free man. By midday, thousands of people, it was impossible to count the numbers, crammed into the Gaza stadium. They waited for hours in the hot sun, waiting to hear the words of a frail, sick man, his body almost completely paralyzed, his voice so weak, even the public address system could not amplify it. Khaled, a young Hamas supporter, was among those here to greet the sheikh.
I'm very happy, really. All the people love Ahmed Yassin, because he's a very distinguished man, I think.
Before he was released last week, Sheikh Yassin was serving a life sentence in an Israeli prison, allegedly for advocating armed attacks against Israelis. But his supporters here in Gaza, like Abdullah Fayoum, say Sheikh Yassin is a man of peace. Sheikh Yassin wants peace, he says, but not the peace of Netanyahu. He wants a just peace. An announcement was made that Sheikh Yassin's helicopter had landed in Gaza, and the crowd here at the stadium went into a frenzy.
Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar.
"We give our blood and our soul for you, Sheikh Yassin," the crowd chanted. Many also cheered Hamas's military wing, which has claimed responsibility for dozens of terrorist attacks against Israelis. Finally, Sheikh Yassin, his head covered in an Islamic scarf, was carried to the podium. The push of the crowd towards Yassin was so great, some people passed out and were taken away by ambulance. Yassin finally spoke, his words so faint they had to be repeated by one of his advisors. "I stand before you," Sheikh Yassin said, "as a representative of the martyrs and of the prisoners. We must continue the struggle," he said, "until they are liberated." Sheikh Yassin also called for unity among the Palestinian people, a clear reference to the growing tensions between Hamas and Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat. Under pressure from Israel and the U.S., Arafat's police have arrested hundreds of Hamas activists and closed down many charitable organizations run by the Islamic movement. It is unclear if Arafat will continue that crackdown now that Israel itself has released the spiritual leader of Hamas, as well as 22 other prisoners. When he founded Hamas a decade ago, Sheikh Yassin openly advocated armed confrontation with Israel. Abdel Aziz Rentisi, a senior Hamas official in Gaza, says he expects Sheikh Yassin, now that he is free, to continue that policy.
I believe that the fixed strategy of Hamas will be enforced by the release of Sheikh Ahmed Yassin. Coexistence with Israelis as occupiers, it's forbidden. And Sheikh will not accept that at all.
But others here believe that in recent years, Sheikh Yassin has moderated his views. In public comments since he was released last week, Sheikh Yassin has struck a fairly conciliatory tone. Speaking to reporters in Jordan, he said Arabs and Jews can live together if Palestinian rights are respected. Ziad Abu Amr, author of a biography of Sheikh Yassin, says the Hamas leader represents a voice of moderation in the Islamic movement.
Sheikh Yassin was one of the first Islamic leaders to talk about a truce with Israel under specific circumstances. Sheikh Yassin is political in many ways. He is willing to negotiate. And perhaps he also is willing to strike compromises.
Compromise has not been one of the guiding principles of Hamas, but some people here in Gaza and many in Israel hope it is a policy that Sheikh Ahmed Yassin will advocate. Eric Weiner, NPR News, Gaza.
In Paris today, Defense Secretary William Cohen declared, "France is among our best allies. We intend to maintain a strong cooperative relationship." He was prompted to make the statement because of a sharp disagreement between the two countries over a French oil company's multi-billion-dollar deal with Iran. News analyst Daniel Shore says the dispute is just one example of how U.S. policies in the Persian Gulf are backfiring.
The Clinton administration's policy of dual containment of Iraq and Iran has run into some strange twists and turns that raise the question of who is containing whom. In one case, deterring Iraq has turned into deterring Iran. Enforcing a no-fly zone against Saddam Hussein in southern Iraq, the United States found that zone being violated by Iranian planes attacking Iranian dissident camps in Iraq. Now the carrier Nimitz is steaming towards the Gulf as a warning to both not to start an air war. In most cases, the U.S. finds itself trying to enforce its sanctions on unwilling allies, defying the threat of punishment under the D'Amato-Iran-Libya Sanctions Act. French, Russian, and Malaysian oil companies are proceeding with a $2 billion contract for Iranian gas field development. In Luxembourg today, the European Union, whose members are sending their ambassadors back to Tehran, formally denounced the United States for trying to get other countries to enforce its laws. Although France has ostentatiously stuck its thumb in President Clinton's eye, the administration is apparently having second thoughts about applying sanctions. Defense Secretary William Cohen was in Paris today trying to patch things up with his French colleague. Russian companies have reportedly delivered another blow to the isolation of Iran by helping the Islamic Republic build a missile with a 1,200-mile range that would bring Tel Aviv and Ankara within reach of Tehran. American intelligence discounts official Russian denials of involvement with missile development in a state labeled as terrorist by the United States. Iraq, meanwhile, has returned to its practice of barring United Nations inspectors from suspected weapons sites. A battle over this is shaping up this week in the Security Council, and the United States is not sure that a move to reimpose sanctions on Iraq will be supported by countries like France and Russia, anxious to resume their commercial ties with Iraq. At one point after another, American efforts to maintain the containment of Iraq and Iran are running into opposition from countries more interested in pursuing their economic interests than a superpower's ideological whims. The danger is that the United States, trying to isolate its Middle East antagonists, will find itself isolated. This is Daniel Shore.